Hello and welcome to our audience here and also to our video conferencing audience to today's talk. And a welcome to Newcastle to Professor Lars Lindholm, who's going to talk to us today on should we be including randomised trials, only randomised trials in our guidelines. Introducing Lars, it's a rather distinguished career, a distinguished career in research, especially hypertension research, and more latterly, he's currently he heads up the National Research School of General Practice in Sweden, which is a collaborative organisation of the seven medical schools in Sweden, and has been extraordinarily successful. School is based in the University of Umeå, where Lars is a senior professor. So I'd like to invite Lars up to tell us about RCTs.
I haven't done anything yet. Good morning. Thanks for having me. And thanks for asking me again for actually the third time in my life to talk about this very difficult topic. Let me be very open and straight with you. The topic was given to me. They do that at world conferences to old farts like me. They give you a hopeless title and expect us to come up with something sensible. It was given to me by the Koreans in September for a world congress on hypertension. And I tried to tackle with it, and I've given the same talk a couple of times as one out of three in Australia, just to sort of try to get it right. Two apologies first to make. First, a minor one, that is I'm using high blood pressure as the example. Now, I tell you where I was invited to talk about it, so it was obvious to use high blood pressure as the example. You could put in anything, but that's what I did. And the second apology is really, and here I really mean it, I will be blowing my own trumpet a bit, and that's mainly because I'm lazy. When looking for examples, why spend time on trying to dig out some other data when you can use some old slides you have already? So do not think of me trying to sell my views on high blood pressure to you. This is not why I have included them. I have included them because I am quite honestly too lazy to sit and make other slides. And doesn't really matter, because these are just examples, and we are going to talk about should we only count randomized controlled trials for clinical practice guidelines. Well, I'm here in Australia to address the Canberra people. The Minister of Health wanted me for a hearing on the research school for 2.5 hours. A room crowded with civil servants, and that was quite interesting. They are so similar to their colleagues in Sweden, and that is the end of my comments on my meeting in Canberra, which went very well. Certainly nice to be out here, because this is the sort of situation I have in Sweden right now, with minus 20, freezing cold. In fact, very similar to Hobart a couple of days ago, where we almost froze to death. With plus 8 degrees, half storm, and rain. So should we only count randomized controlled trials for clinical practice guidelines? Well, for those of you who want to go to sleep and relax and have a nice little nap, I can say this is the answer. So that's it. Now you've got the conclusion. Okay, fine. But the randomized controlled trials are important. Now, I will be critical. And to be honest, I know what I'm talking about, because I've been deeply involved in it. I'm also deeply involved with the Lancet. I'm an advisor there. I sit in during the peer review meetings, and I've done just about everything there is on the list. Reviews, fast-track reviews, writing editorials, writing commentaries, and sitting there being either Lars or family Lars or our friend Lars or poison pen Lindholm, depending on what their thoughts are at the moment. So I know the difficulties, and I also know the difficulties with mega trials, so I'm basing my talk on that. four slides on evidence-based medicine first. Now, evidence-based medicine celebrates its 25th anniversary this year. So it's been around for 25 years. I intercepted a paper at the Lancet, I think now published, sort of a Festschrift, as they say, about evidence-based medicine, and it fits with what I can remember. You know, when it came out, it seemed pretty straightforward to me, really. I mean, an approach to medical practice intended to optimize decision making by using well-designed trials. I mean, who can argue? Do you agree? It seems okay. And they went on saying that you should classify evidence so that only the strongest studies, RCTs, meta-analyses and reviews, could yield strong recommendations. And again, that seems pretty straightforward. I mean, we should build our recommendations on solid, you know, solid rock stuff. So far, so good. Now, if you look up what I've done over my lifetime, I have been involved a couple of times in the, you know, guidelines, the writing of recommendations for the world. I think the most important one, and certainly the worst one, was the WHO and ISH, World Health Organization, and International Society of Hypertension, a collaboration, the guidelines in 1998 for the care of patients with high blood pressure, moderately increased high blood pressure. It wasn't easy, and it was certainly not something I'd like to do again. And when I did it at the time, I was involved mainly to write the practice version of those huge guidelines. I mean, enormous. I somehow thought of my old boss, who said to me, Lars, and he was always mad at me, and then he said, Lars, if you can't carry out research, you can always do clinical epidemiology. And if you can't do a clinical epidemiology, you can always write guidelines. So I did, but that wasn't evidence-based. As for evidence-based, I have been recruited by our government twice to lead a group of, I almost said 12 prima donnas, I meant 12 distinguished cardiologists and physicians writing guidelines about what to do with high blood pressure, affecting more or less the whole population. I did it early out, 25 years ago, when evidence-based medicine was the tiny little toddler trying to walk. And 10 years later, unfortunately, I should have said no the second time, when evidence-based medicine was established. So I think I know what I'm talking about when I'm talking about the difficulties. And what I'll try to give you, today is, in yellow, to pinpoint where the weaknesses are. Because it seems so lovely at first when you look at it, but there are, it's more subjective than you, and less objective than you think. And my undertaking today is to help you see or read what evidence-based medicine really stands for. Okay? And randomized controlled trials, of course. This is the Swedish Council on Technology Assessment. It's very similar to NICE in the UK, if you know what that is. A bit Cochrane inspired, very powerful organization with a lot of money covering medical care in general, and actually quite good. And it's a lot of work, I can tell you. If you go to Wikipedia and look at evidence-based medicine, you will find a couple of meters of limitations. I mean, a lot of people have concerns. It's a bit unfair, really. I mean, evidence-based medicine isn't as bad as it sounds if you look it up under limitation. But I would say, I tried to make sort of four bullet points of where I think you have the limitations. First of all, it's a bit narrow, the definition, and it excludes important information. Those of us have gone into randomized controlled trials, we know that they cost up to billions of Australian dollars to carry out. They are, you want them to run for 10 years, but no one can afford to pay for more than five. There is a great risk of dropouts, and you don't, I mean, come on, those of us have been involved, we all know which patients you do not include, which you leave out, and then that one, oh, she's totally potty, and come on him, he won't show up when he's supposed to. So there's actually a lot of people we don't include in the clinical trials, in the randomized controlled trials, and you underrepresent sick people, you don't include pregnant women, you don't include kids, you take off all the really old ones and so on. And in my area in hypertension, almost all studies have been carried out in older or elderly patients just to get the absolute risk up. I mean, you need a high absolute risk to lower the number of patients included in the trial. And of course, if you show in a randomized controlled trial that a drug can work, it doesn't mean that it actually works in real life when you follow big groups of all patients instead of just a selected group of the best, where you also provide extra services all the time, extra nurses, extra secretaries, and of course accessibility to super specialists all the time, just in case if you want to follow the side effects. But with those four limitations, I think we can just go on and say that evidence-based medicine, they used to call it quality steps, then later they call it quality grades, and I never quite understood the difference between a step and a grade, but it could be my lack of command of English. There are three grades, and it makes sense that at least studies of high quality, then it's grade one. At least one good one and two medium, grade two, and then you've got grade three. What I mean to those of you who are younger here is that if I recommend you to do something in guidelines, recommendation, blah, 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 then within parentheses, you give the grade of that recommendation. So you will see that that recommendation seems to be a strong one and that recommendation is a much weaker one. And that makes sense to me. And when I read it, I am so impressed. It seems so objective and so solid. But is it really as solid as that? Now, how do you go about it? How do you tell, all of you, how do you tell if a study is of high quality or not? Now, had I had 2 hours here, and had I had you closer, I would have asked you, or you, to answer. And you're lucky because I've only got 45 minutes, so I have to answer my own rude questions and show you the weakness. And if I sound arrogant, I'm not, but it's no fun at all standing here giving you a la 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 talk. I need to show you so you can move on. And it's difficult to decide what is high, medium, or low quality. So the answer to that is a big question mark, but you have to have a way to come around it. And there are several ways. Now, I decided to show you one way. It was actually the one we used twice with 10 years in between, and it's no better and no worse than other ways. This is the so-called Fowler and Fulton way of doing it. And it's okay, here we are. So you've got this paper in the BMJ and you need to assess it. Is it of high, medium, or low quality? You follow me? Okay. Well, the 8 bullet points here. You can score 2, 1, or 0. On all of those, but of course that means that you've got a maximum of 16 and you've got a minimum of 0. And then down here you have an overall judgment. Having read the paper, you have an overall judgment. So, you know, this is an overall grade for this paper. It makes sense to me. Is the design appropriate? Is the sub-study sample representative? Is the control group acceptable? The quality of measurements and outcomes, the, you know, compliance, missing data, contamination confounders, strategy for data analysis and strategy for treatment. Makes sense, right? Anyone who gets? I'm not used to an audience as quiet as you. Are you sure you're awake up there? Okay, fine, good. Down here, an overall judgment, that's like a school grade. 540. Anyway, this is, I mean, out of fairness, this sounds, again, it sounds good, doesn't it? So where's the weakness? Well, the weakness is, of course, who decides on the cutoff point? So what do you need for good? Is it 14 and above? Is it 13 and above? Is it 12 and above? And what's good? Well, we all know that A is better than F, right? But what do we do about the B's and the C's? Is B or is it in the middle? And do you need 13, 14 here and a 4 here? Or is it either or do you need both? This is entirely subjective. So this is where the weakness is when you grade with such a nice, and I really love this set of describing and analyzing a study, but it is where you put the cutoff points, that's where subjectivity comes into it. It's a committee which decides. And as long as you remember that this is how it's done, it's fine. But always remember that this is a committee decision. I think we use 14 and above and at least a 3 or possibly at least a 4 for the highest group, but to be honest, I don't remember. Leaving that, let's go over to different types of studies. And I expected some young folks to be in the room, and you are, so maybe it will help you if we go through 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 types of studies. First, the randomized controlled trials. Then, as you can see, subgroups of randomized controlled trials, they come up with high and lower quality grade, maybe this in the same trial. Meta-analysis, very popular in The Lancet. Case control studies, very popular amongst you. Observational study, well, that's what we did when I started in research, and a lot of it. And then, of course, what happened when I started in medicine in 1963 and earlier, this so-called case reports, and we built a lot of, for instance, registration of drugs on case reports. It's true. Three professors writing a recommendation was enough in the early 60s to register a drug. In my part of the world, they often wrote it in German. Ich bin davon ganz überzeugt, dass I'm totally convinced that. So the randomized controlled trials. Let me take the live trial first. It was the first trial where we showed an effect of a more expensive new drug on stroke compared with conventional treatment with beta blockers or diuretics. It was a breakthrough. This paper has been cited more than 3,000 times, and I'm a co-author. It did show that 25% lowering of stroke if you gave an ARB, losartan, instead of a beta blocker. Both groups got a diuretic as add-on treatment, and 40% got a calcium channel blocker as well. Of no interest whatsoever for this presentation, but they were equally well treated, and one group came out better than the other. And there is no doubt whatsoever that this has been considered a breakthrough study of high quality, about 9,200 patients, and a study like this one goes into any famous, well-known scientific journal. The editors fight to get it. They even come and invite you out to lunch, dinner, to persuade you to send it to their journal. And of course, The Lancet won at first, but the New England is winning now because the fast track of The Lancet, which was world famous previously, is there, but it's no longer as important when almost everyone publishes on online. Okay, another one, the ASCOT trial, twice as big. Again, the beta blocker came out less good than the amlodipine, and these were breakthroughs for us in hypertension research, because all of a sudden we could show that something was better than something else. I mean, that these are high quality trials, of course they are, of course there are limitations, but this is sort of straightforward. However, I think it's fair to tell you that smaller trials can also be of high quality and get cited a lot and have an importance. I picked one on my own. This is my PET study, which was, by the way, rejected by The Lancet. It was poorly written at first, and I'm still a bit mad at them for not publishing it. And I, every time I'm there, I try to get in this words like studies of maintenance importance or something linking. And Richard Horton is very, very tired of jokes concerning Alpine. What we wanted to do was to, because in Sweden we can still find groups of never ever, we've got computerized medical records also in primary care. So we wanted a group of never ever treated patients with high blood pressure, sort of virgin hypertensive, that have never received blood pressure lowering treatment. And we wanted to give them the most expensive stuff we could give, which was metabolically neutral and compared with conventional treatment. So, and we did not, over a year, allow any crossover, you know, between the groups, no lipid lowering drugs, and lower blood pressure equally well. Of course, we knew that we were giving expensive medicine to one group and very cheap drugs to the other, and then we looked at the outcome, and of course we looked at health economy of this. Here we go. Well, there was a deterioration of the metabolism if you gave the beta blocker compared with if you gave the more exclusive treatments, the ARB with calcium channel blockers as add-on, and there was a huge difference when it came to the incidence of new diabetes. And those of you who are medics here, you know that once you put the label diabetes on a patient, that patient starts costing money. And the health economy of this is absolutely enormous, because it was almost cost-saving to give expensive drugs compared with giving cheap drugs. And the reason for that was that you avoided new cases of diabetes. I'm showing you this, like I said, not to blow my own trumpet, but to show you that also smaller, and in fact really small, 300-400 patients, randomized controlled trials can be of considered high quality. And I think this is very important to remember. Okay, let's leave the randomized controlled trials and move to subgroups of randomized controlled trials. And they can also be, as you can see on the second and then the third line here, they can be regarded as high quality trial, as high quality, and also regarded as low quality grade. I'll give you two examples. Go back to the LIFE trial. Now, if you go up here, you remember there were 9,222 randomized. I looked at those with diabetes at baseline, type 2 diabetes, and they were, like I said before, randomized into two groups. So, and in fact, we published these papers at the same time in The Lancet as two separate papers. Now, what was so stunning in the diabetic patients was that, look, believe it or not, you lowered all mortality of all causes. You almost halved it. I mean, we don't normally include all-cause mortality. We just have it as a secondary endpoint because it's so difficult to influence mortality of all causes. And in this case, I mean, halving all-cause mortality is absolutely fantastic. And mortality, you see, is a fantastic endpoint, because you're either dead or alive. And we don't have it half dead. And in the real world, outside James Bond's world, you only die once. Whereas you can get coronary after coronary after coronary, or a stroke after a coronary. So this is a beautiful endpoint. You could also have the post hoc analysis, which you cook up afterwards. Same trial, but here it's low quality grade. Here's the regression of albumin in urine. One group, the ARB, doing better than the beta blocker. But another clear example. But this subgroup analysis was cooked up after we finished, whereas the analysis of the diabetics, that was described in the protocol and pre-specified. So towards the end, one is getting a high quality grade and the other one is getting a low quality grade. See what I mean? Okay. The meta-analysis, oh yes they are, every big journal is now full of the meta-analysis, and let us talk about it and let me try to show you where the weaknesses lie with meta-analysis. There are actually quite a few of them, but I'll limit myself to one or two. Now, as for the beta blockers, it started with a live trial. I ended up with two papers in the Lancet, one year apart, where we challenged, we rattled the cage, and how the pharma industry loaded me after this. Media storm both times, being on the first page of every major newspaper in the world, I do not recommend it. Believe me, it is ugly. Having seven American TV chains or networks phoning you in the middle of night is no fun at all, and I have said things to a journalist working for New York Times that not even Mr. Trump dares to say. And it wasn't bugger off, I can tell you. It was 4 o'clock in the morning and my wife had made comments. By the way, you see the question marks in the title here. Atenolol in hypertension, is it a wise choice? I strongly advise you not to put question marks because no one reads them. They took it for granted as if it were a major finding, and we wanted to discuss something based on the fact that a glass half full is also half empty. So if losartan is so much better than atenolol, it follows that atenolol is much not as good as it ought to be. See what I mean? And this is where we got into trouble with the pharmaceutical industry. Not because they sold less of atenolol, there was no profit in atenolol, but we rattled the cage because if the drug you compare with is no good, well then the new shining drug is of course less impressive, even though it's better than something which isn't good. And this has influenced the debate quite a lot. Well, something in yellow here, important. You see, we were going to carry out this first meta-analysis. We looked for trials, included 127,018 trials. And then you come to the third bullet point here, eligibility. And this is where the weakness lies, because you have to sit down and decide which trials should you include. And this is totally subjective. We said that at least half of the patients in one arm should be on a beta block. So what if we put 60%? I don't know. What if we put in 40%? I don't know. What if we required 70%? I don't know. So these data are only valid as long as you take the design into account that we said that at least half of the patients in one group have to be on a beta blocker. Afterwards, show you the results in a moment, we were criticized for not including a study called CAP. I call it CRAP, and I'm the second author of the paper. Before I proceed, is there anyone from Finland in the audience? I see no hand. They're usually tall and muscular, and I'm going to say in that trial it was major cheating in Finland. We had randomization with envelopes, and they must have opened more envelopes than they ought to. If you take the top envelope, and in that envelope you would find the randomization code. We will never do that mistake again. But the thing is, the trial as such was not included. We didn't leave it out because that was cheating. We left it out because no one knows how many people were on a beta block. So that was the reason, because they didn't record how many patients were on a beta block. It was called conventional treatment. It could be beta block or a diuretic. So again, this is immensely important because this could influence the outcome of the analysis. And very few people understand that this is where the weakness lies. It is subjective again. I'm not saying it's bad, but you must realize that this will influence the result. Anyway, quickly, just to show you, as for stroke, if you gave a beta blocker instead of placebo, there was a 90% lowering, as you can see in yellow here, of the incidence of stroke, but we expected 38 from observational data. So it was that there was an effect, but it was half good. If you compared with the beta blocker with other drugs, you had a higher incidence of stroke if you were on a beta blocker, and this was particularly bad for atenolol, where in fact there was an 8% increase in the risk of all-cause mortality. Now, the conclusion which we drew from this was that we as far as trials are concerned, we should not have beta blockers as the drugs you compare with in future trials. And I think that's a solid one, and also up on top, just to make sure that people understand, if beta blockers are, if they aren't less expensive, then we shouldn't start with beta blocker treatment for high blood pressure for moderate to mild hypertension. We should start with something else. They're not cheaper, but they're not as good. And this actually, it led to a clear effect in Sweden, because patients do not they don't get reimbursed for the beta blocker treatment today after 2008, unless you have, the doctor has given you something else previously. So it had an effect. So beta blockers in meta-analysis, I mean, they can be of high quality grade, but remember where their weakness lies. It's how you design it and how you decide who gets into the two arms. And again, I apologize for using hypertension. It could have been anything, and it would have been the same type of discussion. Well, meta-analysis. Franz Messerli said a meta-analysis is much like a bouillabaisse. No matter how much fresh seafood is added, one rotten fish will make it stink. So add a bad trial and the whole thing stinks. On the other hand, said Seward Spencer at The Lancet, a spoonful of port will make a poor French wine drinkable. You can save a meta-analysis by adding a really one or two really good trials. So for meta-analysis, look upon them with love, but be careful and make sure you know which trials were included and how this was defined. So to the young chaps in the room, read the section on methods. Did I make myself clear? Methods should be read, and to the tutors, make sure that they read methods, because if they don't, you can go wrong. I don't know what that is, but it sounds sort of hostile. As for the case control trials, I'm sure several of you carry out nested control trials. They are normally graded as low quality, but they are hypothesis generating. I mean, if you can't carry out a randomized controlled trial, you can always do a nested case control trial. Then you start with those who've had a coronary compared with controls matched for from the population, matched for age and sex and maybe living area. And then you look at a risk factor and you calculate, you estimate the relative risk with an odds ratio. But instead of having a 20-30% increase in risk to be believed, you need a sort of 300% or 400% or 500% increase in risk to really believe it. I love case control trials, and many of them pointing in one direction should and could lead to a prospective randomized controlled trial. But I mean, I think there is general agreement that these trials are not expensive, they're easily done. And if you're careful with how you select the control group, they're quite good, but they won't get above low quality grade in the EBM system. Observational studies, and I think this is really where the problem lies. They are considered low quality grade, and I'm really concerned about this, because we need them. There's no doubt about it that we need them. And let me try to convince you. Let me first take the Framingham Heart Study. Are you aware of the Framingham Heart Study? It's like the Rolls Royce or the Porsche or the Maserati of observational trials. In 1948, they invited most of the men and women living in Framingham outside Boston to an examination. They added some 800 healthy controls, and they have followed them now. They are working on the third generation of that cohort, and they have written more than 1,000 papers, most of them published in really good journals. And should we skip all that? Of course we should skip all that. But there is no way you can get that into the evidence-based way of looking at things unless you deviate a little bit from the strict rules. One example here, high blood pressures first was 160, 95 and above, normal was below 140, 90. And I think it's well known that you have these figures of a threefold increase in risk for CVD death, fourfold for stroke, heart failure, and twofold for MI, threefold if you have a big left ventricle. I mean, these are data so immensely important that it becomes almost embarrassing to say that we shouldn't include them. And when I led those two working groups for the Swedish Ministry of Health I showed you earlier, of course we had to include the Framingham data, even though that didn't really fit into our definition of what we should include. A funny thing is that if you manage to reach 65 in Framingham, the likelihood of you getting high blood pressure over 10, 15 years is actually 90%. It's important to think about. If you retire 65, then you have a 90% risk of getting high blood pressure. So my conclusion is that the only way to avoid hypertension if you live in Framingham is really to die young. Then we got the important post-marketing studies on treatment, and this again is valid not only for high blood pressure but for just about every treatment there is. I think it's fair to say that a randomized controlled trial, it shows that if we talk about drugs, it shows that the drug can work. That's fine. But the effect in the real world, where you include younger and older patients, sick patients, and those with many comorbidities, it has to be established in observational trials. And you've also got all the side effects. I mean, some side effects were obvious during the trial, and as you know, some side effects have been remarkable. Which is the most remarkable side effect in the world, in the book, I think? There is one side effect which makes me wish I was part of the investigators, and I wasn't. It was a drug for treatment of pulmonary hypertension. What? Viagra. The side effect of Viagra led to a lot of money for Pfizer. I'm not going into details. But that's a good example where the side effect has been much more important than the effect on the pulmonary hypertension. It's not a very good drug for pulmonary hypertension, but there are no really good drugs, I'm afraid, for those patients who suffer from pulmonary hypertension. But at least they have an interesting side effect. Post-marketing data are important. Now, when I started in medicine, we used triple therapy for high blood pressure. A diuretic, prothioridone, a beta blocker, it was propranolol, and then we used hydralazine as the third step. And it took about 20 years to discover the side effect, the adverse effect, the SLE type of nephritis after treatment, blood pressure treatment with hydralazine. So it takes a long time sometimes to pick up the side effects. So by all means, do not downgrade observational studies. They are, well, together with the randomized controlled trials, they're actually quite good. But again, you have to be, needless to say, careful that you do not take one or the other. You need both. Case reports, well, low or very low quality grade. But to make the picture complete, out of fairness, like I said, this is how we registered a lot of drugs, actually drugs we use today. I mean, they were actually registered after some case reports. And even today, if it's a very rare disease, it could be that you find three or four cases where something worked, and that usually has a very great impact on the doctor. To say nothing if you've had a disease yourself and something helped. and then you try that stuff on the patients as well. But again, as for grading, it's low or very low quality. Great. So I'm getting towards the end of my talk, but I am not at the end of my talk. But as for should we only count randomized controlled trials for clinical practice guidelines, my answer is no. We need other types of data as well. Now, to amuse you now, I'll make you all a group of EBM fanatics, and we are going to decide together. We're going to carry out an evidence-based medicine analysis of, can anyone guess? Parachute. We want to, someone said that parachute use, it prevents death related to gravitational challenge, which means that parachute use prevents death if we kick people out of an airplane. So does it help to wear a parachute if you are kicked out of an airplane or not? We have now been educated in evidence-based medicine, so we have a question we want to study. So do the parachutes help or not? Well, we make a systematic review of trials, RCTs of course, and others, and what do you think we find? Well, we find some observational data. They seem to help. And they seem to, there is a positive effect. Now, why is Dr. Lindholm showing us this? Is this totally out of line? No, it's not. When it comes to medicine, insulin treatment of type 1 diabetes, where are the randomized controlled trials? Only observational data. Electroshock treatment of patients who drop down with a ventricular fibrillation. Any randomized controlled trials around? No. So it's not all that stupid, is it? Now, this is actually published in a lovely paper in the BMJ Christmas issue, as you know. And now, please, now I'm just quoting Dr. Gordon. Did you get this? Because he says that there should be a trial where we put enthusiastic EBM supporters as guinea pigs into a randomized controlled trial, and half of them get a parachute, and half of them they get a placebo parachute when they're kicked out of an aeroplane up in the air. I didn't say that. Dr. Gordon wrote it, and my interpretation is that I think we will have less of our enthusiasts for EBM after that. But as often in medicine, and this is really where I am coming to the end of my talk, you can't be sure. Do you always need a parachute if you drop out of an airplane? No, you don't. On the 31st of July last year, a man jumped from 7,600 meters without a parachute. And I managed to save a photo of it, which was published, I think, in the New York Times. And he survived. He was picked up on ground in a net, and he survived. Here he is, cheering. So, like so often in medicine, it's fine according to the rules, but there is always the outlier. Thank you so very much for your attention. Pleasure. Quite happy to take yeah. questions.
So thank you, Lars. Do we have any questions? And also we'll ask if there are questions in the video conference people in the room too. So any questions for Lars?
Shout, my hair. You know the loudspeakers are facing you and not me. So please, but shout. Sir,
I didn't see N of one trials in your list of methods, and I wonder could you see N of one trials being the basis for drug licensing?
You always want confirmation. I mean, but sometimes in one trial you come up with something, and the problem is that most of us we really want a confirmatory data. I think that is, I don't know about the Australian Drug Agency, but quite normally they want more than one trial. So often often you have a series of maybe observational data or cross-sectional data, then you have a series, some case control studies, and then you make come up with one confirmatory randomized controlled trial. That would I think be enough.
Okay, any other questions?
Yes, sir. Shout.
I'm interested in your thoughts. Thank you very much for a fantastic
presentation. Yeah, sure. Everyone says that. You're really a bad talk. Now you've got a question.
I'm interested in your thoughts in the relevance of context in your conclusion. So you're saying randomized control trials are not always important, and we have these other examples of, so you gave an example of parachute.
Yeah. But we're often in that situation in medicine.
Sorry?
Yeah, we're often in that situation in medicine that things we do, cortisone, penicillin, insulin, that we don't the data we cook up now is just, we have to have these type of studies. Well, come on, look at what you're doing and how much of that is based on stuff where we didn't have them. Yeah. Come again.
However, the context in some of the data you provided, so hypertension, for example, and its impact on mortality over a long period of time, I think it was 60 months, is completely different to jumping out of a
definitely
or giving someone an electrical shock to.
Sure, of course it is. Of course it is.
And so does that know, I guess the question is, does that know always hold true depending on that context?
I think it's, if you took randomized controlled trials and you stopped them after 2 years, let's just say that we invented the rule that we're only going to have, we don't allow randomized controlled trials to continue more than 2 years. I think I'm absolutely sure that the outcome will be less good than if you allow the trial to go on. Now, the trial I'm dreaming of, I won't experience it, but what I'm dreaming to see is a 10-year randomized controlled trial, but we had enough time to see the effect and the side effects of treatment. The LIFE trial had a budget around $1 billion Australian dollars, if I remember correctly, or close to $1 billion. I mean, it's so expensive with these randomized controlled trials. So as soon as, and there's also an ethical part of that. If you, for instance, in the diabetics here, if you have to have the safety committee makes these analyses advising you whether you can continue or not, and I can promise you, and they would have been looking at not only the patients, but all patients, but also at the diabetics. And if something close to an effect on all-cause mortality came up, they would have told us to stop. I mean, like the SPRINT, if you follow hypertension research, the SPRINT trial now, that was stopped because there was an effect when you lowered blood pressure much more than we do today compared with regular treatment. So you are... Just to go back, you're right, you would have a different outcome if you looked at 2 years or 10 years or 5 years, but we are often around 5 years, at least in my part of science. Yes, sir?
There's a lot of focus on randomized controlled trials, a lot of resources. What about with post-marketing surveillance? Is that sufficiently resourced, do you think?
It's certainly, it helps us a lot, and we have the help of the pharmaceutical industry here and the requirements of the FDAs around the world, whether it's in Australia or within the EU or the United States, where I think companies with new drugs, they are ordered to follow up for 10 or 20 years. I think the examples I gave, for instance, the nephritis after hydralazine treatment is a very good example of something we had no idea that it was there. The opposite, of course, is the Viagra side effect, which was pretty obvious after taking the tablet. But you're right. Now, my message, I hope it came across, is that we need all of it. We can't, I just want you, the maybe stupid comparison with parachute jumping, but it's still funny. It is that it's not all that different from medicine. I mean, just going for something obvious but also central, cortisone, penicillin, insulin, it is no better. We based it on case reports and also, I mean, Fleming, when he was standing there with his in his basement looking at this and then started it with the penicillin stuff. I mean, that's the way it was. But today we sound so sophisticated. We want all these Rolls Royce around us. Oh yeah, working on hypertension. You have to be careful when you mention the word Rolls Royce because we're always suspected of being bought by industry. Mm-hmm. I can tell you, you go ahead and rattle the cage with beta blockers and industry drops interest in you immediately. Believe me, they have fun at all. Okay, sir, just shout. Who was first of the two of you? Lady first.
Thank you. So, like, when you were talking about the quality of the evidence that folder.
Yes.
So what you're saying is basically within the framework of grade system, which now is being used for...
Steps first and grade now. That's how they do it. Yeah.
Exactly. So I wanted to know, because since within the domains of grade system, they basically observational studies with large size and...
Yeah, they are down.
High, actually. Yeah. So I just wanted to see what is your thoughts on that.
Well, my thought on that is really that... I mean, it is difficult to argue against the fact that we should have quality data and that we should base our recommendations on evidence and we should try to grade the quality. But what I try to show you is how subjective it is, and it is committee work. It's a consensus of a committee where you put the cutoff points. And to make it worse, if you go to the paper I showed you, there were two sets of variables, one with 1 to 5 and one with 8. So is it the first, the second, or is it both? And that is entirely subjective based on a committee. And as you know, in a jury, do you have a jury system in Australia?
Yes.
Oh, you do. Well, often there is one person who is the leader and is very pushy. And it's the same with this type of committee work. And, well, I suppose... I'm one of those. I feel very guilty right now. I'm the pushy type, and then there are some gentle, nice people like you who try to argue, and you know, maybe not, but then often a group of men take over. And of course, as long as you remember that this is the way it's been done, it's fine. I mean, the peer review system, we all agree it's bad, and we can't come up with something better. And it's the same with this. And what I'm trying to make you understand, also with the meta-analysis, that you need to go for these really red bullet points because this is how, because they influence the outcome so much. Somebody up there, sir?
It seems that we're always talking about a trade-off of, you know, confidence, you know, approaching certainty in an inference versus having more information about a range of, you know, breadth of information. So depth versus breadth, something like that. And, you know, the insulin example is problematic now because there were lots of errors made.
Of course.
In that same period. And I don't think you're advocating for case reports being, a lot of resource being spent on case reports.
No.
So I'm wondering whether an implication of your argument is that we should do fewer trials, but they should be larger and with longer follow-up.
Well, I go along with that. We should spend money on longer trials and we should, I mean, sometimes you cannot carry out a randomized controlled trial because if there is a rumor that you may get cancer somewhere in the world if you use a certain type of treatment, I mean, no ethics committee will allow you to set up a randomized controlled trial about that. And using placebo, I mean, comparing blood pressure lowering treatment with placebo treatment, it was allowed in China up until a couple of years ago, but it is no longer allowed. And of course, it is not. We can't go down that road. Then you have to cook up something in between with what we call surrogate endpoints. So you use either the size of the heart or albumin or microalbuminuria or something as a surrogate endpoint in the trial. But my dream, like I said, is to see one really long trial which authorities allow you to continue. Now, I've been on a few safety committees. And believe me, it is very, very difficult to let the study go on when you start to smell, is this ethically okay? And as you know, you're very close to significance, and it goes up and down. It could be 0.04999. Where do you say stop? And people are always mad at you if you stop the trial. And you are afraid of the lawyers and the authorities, lawyers in the US, as a big concern if you let a study continue. So in my world, it's often been the safety committees. That's a group of peers, friends, not really friends, but other colleagues who are totally separate. And they are the ones who decide if your trial may go on or not. Afterwards, when studies have been stopped, there's always a lot of quarreling afterwards. So just to summarize the take-home messages, randomized controlled trials are fine. They're part of what you need. I may not love evidence-based medicine, but I like it. Just remember that there are limitations. Be careful with meta-analysis and always look at methods at that section to find out what how it was done and which trials were included and how did they define whatever they're looking at. And finally, ladies and gentlemen, if you feel like jumping out of an aeroplane, use a parachute. Thank you.